I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
The first time I went to the French Open, I definitely felt, wow, I'm in the continent of Europe. And here are foreign, you know, European journalists and different food and language. Absolutely a sense of a little more exotica. There's some journalists I joke, I said, yeah, you're really a spy. You're working for, you know, Spectre or 007 or something.
The date is May 26, 2020, and that is Joel Drucker, our guest on this special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. As always, our great thanks to Sam Pellegrino for covering the production costs of these special reports. We wouldn't have been able to deliver them to you without them. Our guest today is Joel Drucker, who I will properly introduce in just a moment. But first, I do want to let you know what the drill is for this week. First of all, at the end of last week, I mentioned that I would have a new show for you on Monday. The days and weeks have blurred together so much that when I recorded that intro, I did not realize that Monday yesterday was Memorial Day, so that's why there was no show yesterday. You are not imagining things. If this is the next episode that you are listening to, it is dropping on Tuesday, so my apologies for that confusion. And I also wanted to let you know, we are now down to our last three special reports. We will have one today, Tuesday, May 26th. We are skipping a day Wednesday because of the way I was able to get interviews scheduled this week. And our last two special reports will be this Thursday and Friday. I will then take a short break and then be back with weekly episodes that'll run 75 to 90 minutes, I would guess. For the foreseeable future. So that's what's going to be happening here on the show. Getting to today's guest, Joel Drucker. As a lot of longtime listeners to this show know, I'm a huge tennis fan. Today might be a slight indulgence, but I think you will find it interesting. By way of background, I wrote about tennis for about 10 years. I co-authored James Blake's memoir, Breaking Back. James was a top five U.S. player. I wrote for Tennis Magazine and Tennis.com. Someone I got to know during my years doing that was Joel Drucker, who's one of the great American tennis writers. He's been at it for a little bit under four decades now. And Roland Garros, better known to most people probably as just the French Open, would have begun this weekend. It is the first of the four Grand Slams of which we are being deprived this year. It's something that a lot of tennis fans around the world are, you know, really feeling right now, much as, you know, a lot of you listening to this are missing going to work and missing going to bars and restaurants. A lot of us are really missing watching live tennis, hearing the roar of the crowd, watching a match that we don't know the outcome of yet, those tense final moments of each set that can be so dramatic. For those of us lucky enough to live in a place or be able to travel to places where these tournaments are held, you know, missing being in a crowded arena or even an outer court where there's just a few hundred seats, and watching tennis live is something that we're definitely missing. We don't know how long we will be missing it. It might be for the rest of this year in any large-scale way. We're actively having discussions about there being possibly Grand Slams later this year with no fans in the seats, which, you know, on television, I'll take it. But as someone who's experienced that amazing sensation of being in a crowded tennis arena, that still makes me a little bit sad. But I thought it'd be a good time to invite someone from that world on the show, since the French Open would have begun this past weekend. And Joel is someone who, like I said, I've gotten to know a little bit over the years. He is originally from New York, currently lives in Oakland. He's very up on the kind of history of the Bay Area, especially Berkeley and its place in American culinary history. He's someone that I always chat about chefs with when I run into him at tournaments. And I thought it'd be just a fun time to have Joel on to talk about the tournaments around the world and also the food associations that he makes with the different tournaments, because he's been going to them for such a long time. As I said, he's been at this for about 35 years. He's also contributed to broadcast tennis coverage on HBO, CBS, the Tennis Channel, and other networks and outlets. Currently does a lot of writing for tennis.com, which is owned by the Tennis Channel. He is also the author of a book that I just love. It's called Jimmy Connors Saved My Life. I read it long before I ever got to meet Joel in person. It's a deeply personal memoir, both about Joel and about one of the great American tennis players, and also one of the great controversial American tennis players. And if you're looking for a fun summer read, if you are someone who does like tennis, I highly recommend that you get your hands on that or download it to your Kindle or read it, however you do that kind of thing. In any event, Joel and I spoke at the end of last week. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. So without any further ado, here's my chat about tennis, food, and travel with Joel Drucker. So Joel, thank you for joining us on the show. You know, you are one of these people of whom I am supremely envious, because if I had known where my true love lay when I was younger, I would have become a tennis writer. You're one of the best at what you do. And I thought it would be fun, since you can't be at Roland Garros this year and I can't be watching it. It would have started this weekend. I thought it might just be fun to talk a little about food and tennis and how they intersect and your associations that you make on the road as you travel to tournaments. What do you miss most about not being able to be at Roland Garros?
Well, Roland Garros is a real texture to the tournaments. And it's funny that you mentioned we're talking about food in Roland Garros, because Roland Garros, I guess because of the nature of the clay, seems the most, how would I put it, the most edible of the majors, because that clay, the color of that clay when you first see it is so evocative. I mean, it's got this, what looks like cheddar cheese or something. And it's so, textured, the clay. And I miss watching a match on one of the smaller courts, the famous Bullring court. This new court 18 that opened a few years ago is really fun. And I miss the chance to kind of wander into a match that isn't necessarily that crowded, but be able to watch the players from fairly close and just see how physical the tennis is for the players. That's the part I miss most. And no tournament shows off the physicality more of tennis than Roland Garros and the French Open, because of the rigor it takes to win points on clay.
Yeah, it's funny. The only major tournament I've had the pleasure of covering is the U.S. Open, which I did quite a bit for about 10 years. But the word I always think of when I think about clay courts in general and Roland Garros in particular is gladiatorial.
Very much so. I mean, you know, particularly you go into that Châtrier, which is the main court there, and it does have that gladiatorial quality, because the clay and the work, and you see someone, of course, like Rafael Nadal has brought that metaphor to life like no one in the history of the sport. And it's very mano a mano, very physical, balls bouncing high with the top spin. And there's just this whole sense of the players in combat. I mean, that works out at other venues too, because of the very nature of tennis. But the French Open is really like that. And maybe there's something about the whole beauty of Paris in May and June. I mean, it's such, as we all know, it's such a beautiful, enchanting city and so much. And so here the tennis is part of it too.
I mean, obviously when you think about food, I mean, until not all that long ago in human history, the first place one probably would have thought of, at least from in the Western world, is France and is Paris. What are the associations you make or rituals maybe that you have either on the grounds of a tournament, which is its own universe, and then in the larger universe of Paris as a dining destination?
The food at the French Open, there's a broadcast center that has some nice array of foods. I mean, the hot dog at the French Open is pretty good. It's kind of got a long hot dog with a long bun and the Dijon like mustard, and how it's kind of spicy. So that's pretty good. I mean, I think of treats. I have a sweet tooth, so they have different ice creams are fantastic. I mean, Paris If you're into the butter, cream, cheese, I mean, you could just, Paris would be the place to be always. And a few times I've gone to Entrecote, the steak place. Chez André was a place, the late Barry McKay, who was a broadcaster and former pro who I work with quite a lot, he liked going to that place. And I remember going there with him, and I'm trying to remember what we had. We had some remarkable chicken, and then I think we had some, did we have some oysters? I mean, I think the one, a big takeaway from the French Open, though, is you really can't find a bad meal. I mean, I stay at a place fairly close to the Roland Garros, and it's actually not even Paris. It's called the Issy Melanou, which is just outside of Paris. And even then, you can find pretty good foods. I mean, whether it's salads or fish. So it's just the sense that there's going to be, you can't find bad food there. There's the hotel I stay at, there's a sushi place across the street that I sometimes in a term I've gone to as many as 8 times. I mean, I'm coming back late from a tournament. It's 10:30, 11 at night. I need to get up at 6 the next morning. I'm going to go to this place, and it's really, really good sashimi and soup. I just always find everything there is kind of impeccably prepared, no matter where you're going.
Before we started rolling tape on the interview, you know, you mentioned, you know, you covering a tournament, it's not like you can always run out and have some, you know, fabulous dinner in Paris. I mean, can you just speak for a moment to the schedule of a journalist covering one of these slams? Because I think the days are longer, and I think the cumulative toll over 14, 15 days is probably greater than a civilian might assume.
Well, and Paris is actually fortunate because until now, there's no night play. So there's a cap to the day. But we'll talk about Paris, though, as an example. If I'm at a tournament, this, for example, when I was at the last time I was at Roland Garros, I was responsible for writing, let's say, 2 stories a day for tennis.com. And that meant there'd be one of the first matches of the day. But if that match starts, let's say, at 11 or noon, I need to be there probably a half hour, an hour before just to get organized. So that means I'm leaving where I'm staying at, let's say, 9 or 9:30. But then the match starts, a match starts at noon. It's a woman's match. That could end at 2:30. I need to wait for a player in the press conference. I have a story due by 5 o'clock. And then there's another match that I'm also going to write about. The match may have started at 4 or 5, so I've got to write about that one. So a typical day when you're working in journalism there, you're going to be at a tournament a good 12 to 15 hours. I mean, if there's a night match, it can be longer. Sometimes it depends on the schedule, and sometimes there are other things. One year I was in Australia, and I had an interview I needed to do, and the player was only available at 8 in the morning. I did the interview at 8 in the morning, and then there's a match to write about at noon. And there's another match to write about 6. So I was churning through tennis, I'd say, that day from about 8 a.m. to about 1 a.m.
That is not atypical.
That's not atypical. That's right. Those kind of days happen. And you just – and it's kind of going from thing to thing. And then I'm not even going to get into the whole – when I worked a lot in television production, that had its own rhythm too of getting – and in a way, it's funny you mentioned food. I compare TV production to being a bit of a sous chef. I had to prepare – information and data for commentators that they could then use in subsequent parts of the broadcast. So I was doing the equivalent of chopping garlic and parsley so they would have the thing. So in the course of the day, we could cook up the show. So there's a lot of television production. There's a lot of preparation that goes into making a TV show. And that involves, you know, getting ahead of things so you can have information and have it ready to go. It's at 10 a.m., 11 a.m., et cetera.
Well, let's go chronologically through the tournaments that, you know, sadly, we're probably not going to have this year. So after Roland Garros, normally there would be Wimbledon. You know, the casual observer has probably, you know, if you're old enough, remember, you know, this NBC and Breakfast at Wimbledon and this notion of strawberries and cream. You know, people familiar with British culture, you know, and at this time of year that we're finding our way into, think of something like the Pimm's Cup. But what is the actual breadth of what's on offer at a tournament like Wimbledon?
One of the fun things about staying at Wimbledon is at being at Wimbledon, we often stay these days in the Wimbledon Village. A number of years ago, it became a little, took too much time to get from London to Wimbledon. I mean, that's a good 45 minutes to an hour to get there. So a great many people, including myself and others, stay in this Wimbledon Village, which is a nice, comfortable 10 or 15 minute walk. In the village, there's a nice wide range of restaurants. There's a Thai place, there's an Italian place, there are a couple of Indian places. I think the Indian food is always delightful to eat in London. When I was staying in London and I was working with HBO and TNT, there were some Indian places that were near our hotel that were really delicious. And I can almost conjure up the taste of some of them from when I was sleep deprived after working a long day and eating dinner late at night. And something about the senses, you smell things more when you're tired. And I can conjure up the smell of something like chicken tikka or tandoori or something like that. The Wimbledon Village, I really like. There's a place called Wimbledon Tandoori. So that's just really good Indian food. On the grounds, some of the food, there's sandwiches, there's salads, and then there are the things that are kind of like the staples that you mentioned, Pim's, strawberries and cream, which the first time you go, anytime you go to Wimbledon, probably the first time, that's important to have. That's part of the ritual of having that. I like, again, this gets to me and my personal sweet tooth. They have these candy merchants at Wimbledon where you can get up little bags by, you know, you can get like, you know, 3 caramels and 5 chewy things. I like, when I've covered Wimbledon in the past, getting a bag of those things and then wandering around the grounds. It's kind of like walking through like a tennis smorgasbord while I'm kind of eating my own confections.
Now, the tournament I'm most familiar with, because I live in New York, and for the years that I did work with Tennis Magazine and Tennis.com, I for probably a decade was a credentialed person at the Open covering it. I mean, the food at the U.S. Open gets a lot of coverage. A lot of it's very focused to the chagrin of Levy Restaurants, which has the food service contract there. A lot of it's always focused on price. People seem to feel you get gouged at the U.S. Open. But it is extensive. Do you have favorite things at the U.S. Open that you look forward to eating on the ground?
In the media area, they sometimes have, each day they'll sometimes have some fish, which hasn't been bad. It's improved in recent years. Some salmon, that's pretty good. Salad bar. One place, sometimes I find, because I'm working so long, I get into kind of these rituals of having the same thing again and again. So I remember one year I just kept having a lot of hummus at this one place. That was pretty good. So it's nothing, there isn't a specific thing. I don't think of a U.S. Open food the way I would think of strawberries and cream or the Roland Garros hot dog on the baguette. I have a friend who liked the Frank sausage.
It's funny you say that, because back to when I was just a fan in the seats, and it's just something they've always had available there at the concession. There's a sausage with onion and peppers sandwich. You know, it's like on a hot dog bun, basically. And that is almost Pavlovian to me. I cannot have a full day at the tennis center without having that. And then I cannot leave at night without having had a Ben and Jerry's ice cream bar.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Ben and Jerry's. I remember one time when I was going to the U.S. Open, it was Haagen-Dazs. And I remember I went through a whole Haagen-Dazs phase, I think, like every day.
Yeah, it's weird how, you know, like you said, you get into these little grooves where it just becomes like a ritual almost. What about New York City? Are there places you look forward to coming back to in New York?
You know, I was born in New York and I lived there till I was 7. And you talk about Pavlov and going back to something like the Marcel Proust remembering. The first time I ever had pizza was in New York. And everyone knows about the famous New York cheese pizza, right? So when I go to New York, I think once or twice a tournament, I'll take time in Manhattan. I'll go to someplace. It doesn't have to be the definitive Ray's pizza. It just has to be a reasonable pizza place, 2 slices, something to drink, you know, $7 and a black and white cookie afterwards. That's kind of a nice, pretty tidy, what do you call it, about a $10 ritual?
Yeah, maybe 12 now, but yeah.
That kind of stuff is fun to eat. And places like Essa Bagels. I couldn't believe when I went there, wow, people waiting in line like this for bagels, but they're good.
Yeah, there's a lot of loyalty amongst the bagel knowledgeable. Catch me up on what's going on in do you live actually in Berkeley?
I live in Oakland, right next to Berkeley.
What's the vibe like there? How are people, or is there, in terms of the foods? I mean, it's such a food-rich city. It's so rich in history. How are people handling this moment where so many places have had to be, at least to dine-in service, had to be closed?
A lot of people I know are cooking more things. I have a friend, and his friend I can tell is clearly inspired by some of these past cuisine things. They're experimenting. This person is experimenting with soup. Another person I know is teaching herself how to make breads. I mean, there's just, I think one thing about this area, there's a lot of food consciousness. It's kind of like all ships rise. You know, it's like you're living in this area makes people inadvertent foodies, whether they like it or not. I mean, when I was in college, I remember it was the late 70s, early 80s, and going to places like Chez Panisse, of course, and Santa Fe Bar and Grill, and knowing who these chefs are. And there's a certain kind of consciousness around food. I mean, you've got these great bread makers like Acme and Semi Freddy, and people are very attuned to those kind of things. And I think they're eager to kind of get going and eating again. But I think in the short term, then they're kind of cooking themselves. I mean, there's just such a sort of consciousness about that stuff here, whether it's organic foods or, you know, like this for people here, the arrival of Whole Foods was not a revelation. It was just like, okay, here's a mass market version of kind of the stuff a lot of us have been having for years anyway.
Right. Here's the big box version of our normal life.
People in this area are so proud of knowing their little market that has the great organic blueberries, or they know what time to go, the best to go to the Cheese Board Collective. And they kind of, there's a little one-upping on all of that.
My personal feeling, and I'd love to know yours, is that I don't think we're going to see a Grand Slam tournament this year. Do you? I think it's going to be the Australian Open.
I just don't know. You know, I was kind of intrigued, and this is where I'll ask, you know, you who's in New York, Governor Cuomo mentioned something about sports events a few days ago, and I think that kind of cast a theory that, maybe there can be some kind of spectator-free U.S. Open. It's just thinking of how all the parts and pieces to make a live sports event happen. And I think in a way, maybe I know too much because I've been around these events so long to think about all the parts and pieces that are involved in it, whether it's trainers and officials and lots of things. So I think we're crossing our fingers, but we just don't know.
Well, my big concern is, take away the spectators, to do a full roster, you'd have people from so many different countries. It's hard. That is the piece that I can't get my head around being worked out. I don't know. I hope they have it. Nothing would make me happier.
I agree with you. It'd be nice to see, but I think they are just trying to figure out how this stuff can work. And I think we're learning more stuff about how this virus, how it affects people and what distancing is and protocols and lots of stuff.
So the first slam of the calendar year, not historically always, but for a long time now, is the Australian Open. I've never been to Australia. That's the one country we're talking about. I've never been there. I've always wanted to go.
The great thing about Australia, about the Australian Open, is, among many things, is that it's in the city where it's played closely. So imagine that you're staying in Midtown and you're walking to Columbia to play for the tournament. You know, maybe even closer. In other words, so that's really, that brings a certain quality to it that none of the other slams quite have. The French, if you're in the exciting part of Paris, it's a bit of a ways to go to get out to the tennis. Ditto for New York, as we know, and also for Wimbledon. We're in the village, but then we're not in London. So the Australian has both going, and that's pretty neat. And of all the majors, the one I've most been able to partake of the food, and partially because of the flow of some of my work schedule, particularly the years I was working in doing a lot of television production work with Tennis Channel, there are more times for more different meals. So Australia, great food. You have some tremendous Greek food. In Melbourne, where it's played, is a large Greek population. So there's some great Greek restaurants where I've had a lot of fine meals there. There's a whole Chinatown and had some great Chinese food there. There are a lot of fusion stuff. There's a place called Longgrains that I've gone with several of my colleagues. That's kind of a mix of kind of, you know, Asian, and it's got some other flavors to it. So I've had a lot of good meals there. And I also, I had a ritual. There's one of these classic downtown sandwich places. And I had the same sandwich that I got like every year for like 3 years, that I would get two of them in the morning and bring them to the tournament. I had this avocado and tomatoes and arugula, which of course is also known as rocket, which is kind of nice given that Rod Laver His nickname is Rocket, the great tennis player. So I had the same sandwich every day for 2 years that I would call them, I order it in advance, get it on my way to work, because I had to be at work then at about 7 a.m. And I would get this sandwich around 6:45 in the morning. It just felt like a whole, like an assembly line. It was just great. It's also a little exotic to be in January and it's winter in America, but here we are in the summer in Australia.
Yeah, well, that's something to me that's always been so, again, I mean, American journalists don't really do it as much as other countries do. You know, there's some Brits who do it, but these people who really follow the tour, I mean, you're basically chasing summer around the earth.
That's exactly right. You know, and I live in California where it's fairly nice weather year round, but still in Northern California, it's a little chilly in December and January. And then boom, we're in Australia and it's about 82 degrees outside and it's definitely their summer. And it is really a neat feeling. And, lots of good food. A couple of years ago, I took some time to go to Sydney beforehand, some tremendous Italian food and just a sophistication around food and a real quality engagement. Even at some of the coffee shops I went to, some interesting twists on sandwiches and seafood and just a lot of adventurousness around food.
Yeah, I've always had this fantasy trip where I wanted to go to Sydney for a week to more or less to eat and drink, go to a week of the Australian Open, and then go check out the Great Barrier Reef, and then come home. I always felt like I would need to spend that much time there for it to be worth the travel time.
Well, you probably want to spend at least 10 or 12 days there, and if you could make it longer, well done. But yeah, I haven't been to the Great Barrier Reef, but both Sydney and Melbourne were tremendous, wonderful cities. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for calling in. I appreciate you sharing these thoughts. It does make me even more wistful. I mean, let's be honest, right? You cover it. It's your work. But I think most people I've ever met who cover tennis or even are on the periphery of it, people like chair umpires, it does tend to be a community of people who first and foremost love the sport.
A lot of them do. I know I do. I mean, because I went to tennis tournaments when I was a child and I still keep all my credentials. I have a big bin with all my credentials and that's really fun. And it's neat to go to these tournaments and have a chance to write about it and a chance to engage with it. And the work stuff is a lot of fun a lot of times. And it can be, of course it's long hours and it's work, but it's a pretty good way to make a living and do things. And it's also nice to, hang out in these cities and have some moments where you get to have meals with colleagues and hang out with people who I've been around with all over the world. I find that kind of interesting. Like, I think there's someone who I've worked with, I figure out we've probably, dined in 10 cities. And there's something kind of fun about that.
I mean, the limited time I've spent around, I mean, there's the Open. I mean, the time where I felt like I really got a window into it was the one time I came out to Indian Wells. You were there that year. There's a bar that at least a number of us went to every night called the Beer Hunter. there is this like foreign correspondent vibe, like when I was with everybody there, I started, thinking of movies I'd seen, like The Year of Living Dangerously,
a little bit like that.
That's what you guys seemed like to me. It's like you were all in this newsroom all day. It was hot. And then at the end of the night, we'd go someplace and drink, just drink endless amounts of beer and eat nachos and come back and do it the next day.
It feels like David Halberstam and Peter Arnett in Saigon. It's not quite as dangerous, but what's that hotel? They use the Hotel Caravelle or something. And you got your people. It has some of that quality. It takes on a little different shape in different parts. I've been going to Indian Wells since I was a teenager to that tournament in prior incarnations. So that's a little familiar to me in ways, but it was I could see how it was exotic to you. And the first time I went to the French Open, I definitely felt, wow, I'm in the continent of Europe. And here are foreign European journalists and different food and language. Absolutely a sense of a little more exotica. There's some journalists I joke. I said, yeah, you're really a spy. You're working for, Spectre or 007 or something.
Well, on that intriguing note, Joel, thank you so much. And I hope we get live tennis soon, and I hope we're able to go to restaurants soon.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
And that's our show for today. Again, our great thanks to Joel Drucker for being our guest. You can learn more about Joel at joeldrucker.com. and you can follow him on Twitter. The handle is at Joel Drucker. Again, please do check out our Patreon page and consider supporting this show directly. The website is Patreon, patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. If you enjoyed this show, please explore our archives at AndrewTalksToChefs.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Please be sure to hit the subscribe button on those platforms. It is free, and new episodes will drop automatically into your podcast queue as they are launched. And we would also love it if you would please rate or review the show, especially at Apple Podcasts. And if you would tell your friends by text, email, word of mouth, or social media, however you do that kind of thing, if there are people in your life who you think might enjoy the show. Thanks to Wild Turkey Surprise for today's opening music, and to After School Special for the music you are listening to right now. Please seek them out online and enjoy more of their music. Thanks to our engineer, Margaret Kelly, for mixing these special reports. Thanks to Sam Pellegrino for making these special reports possible. And thank you to all of you for listening. Please take care of yourselves, take a breath, and we will all get through this together. See you back here on Thursday.